Hi, this is Debbie Weil. I welcome you to another interview on the topic of writing, designing, publishing, or marketing a short ebook.
Welcome. Welcome, David Meerman Scott. This is Debbie Weil, and this is Beta Author Boost. David is the best-selling author of 8 books, including 3 international bestsellers. He's a professional speaker. He speaks all over the world. David, I followed you on Facebook, and you're always in Latvia or someplace like that.
The last place was Morocco.
That's even better. On topics including marketing, leadership, and social media, and you're a marketing strategist, and you also advise companies. And you're also a friend and a colleague, and I feel like we've known each other for years.
Yeah, 10 years at least, I think.
And so thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
It is my pleasure. Happy to be here.
It's very exciting. I thought it would be fun for those listening if you could start and briefly tell us how a PDF manifesto launched your first book, and that is your biggest bestseller, The New Rules of Marketing PR.
Yeah, sure. So I started blogging in 2004, so I was reasonably early with blogging. And then in late 2005, I just sort of got enamored with this idea that the nature of what a press release is has changed. So I wrote a PDF ebook called The New Rules of PR. And I did a couple of things that a lot of people don't do with that. Number one, I had it professionally edited. So I hired an outside editor to help me to go through it. Number two, I hired a designer to do a good job at doing the layout and doing the graphics and whatnot. I made it landscape orientation, so it fits really nicely onto a computer screen. And those things are pretty rare at the time, because at the time, and this is late 2005, at the time most people were doing traditional white paper style, not very well designed, text-heavy kind of documents. And I put it out on my blog in the very early 2006, and my blog wasn't that popular. I had a few followers, but it wasn't nothing really exciting. And a few things happened quickly. The first thing that happened was the same day I put it out, Seth Godin blogged about it. He had, at the time, I think he may still have, the most popular marketing blog in the world. And that day, 8,000 people downloaded the ebook. The next day, a guy called Steve Rebell blogged about it. He at the time was the most popular PR blogger in the world. He hated the ideas, Steve Rebell did, and Seth Godin loved the ideas. So now you've got the most popular marketing blogger in the world loving it, the most popular PR blogger in the world hating it, and me thinking this is the best thing in the world that could possibly happen because they're arguing about my ebook, which of course drove tons of downloads. So I had 50,000 downloads the first month. Now, I made it totally free with no registration, and that's critical to the strategy, is nobody had to jump through any hoops to get it. They didn't have to give me an email address. They didn't have to do anything. But now that it had 50,000 downloads in just a single month, I had ammunition to go to publishers. I emailed an agent, and it was given to me, his name was given to me as a recommendation. I emailed him, his name is Bill Gladstone. I emailed him, and he got back to me in less than half an hour with a contract. All I did was say, I just wrote an ebook, here's a link to the ebook. It's had 50,000 downloads. Here's what Seth Godin said. Here's what Steve Rebell said. Here's what some other bloggers said. And that's what it took for them to decide to sign me. And then he sold the book to Wiley in a very short period of time, which became what's now The New Rules of Marketing and PR. And that came out. So I wrote it throughout 2006. It came out in mid-2007.
Well, I remember when it came out, and
because your corporate blogging book came out probably a couple months before.
Like a couple months before. It came out in August of 2006.
Yeah, that's right.
I also actually had a sort of a manifesto that it wasn't as successful as yours, but it was, in fact, kind of the basis of the book. It was on the Change This site. But
yeah.
Anyway, because it's a cool idea. Quick question. Do you think you're still doing the PDF manifestos? and you mentioned the no registration and the no email, because a lot of the wisdom now is, you know, if you at least require an email so you can build your list. You're not worried about that because you have so many blog readers, so it doesn't really matter.
No, I don't think that's not the way my mind thinks. I think for me, it's better to have my ideas spread than it is to get an email address. And in my experience, because I've tested this and I've had a number of other people who have tested this, when you require an email address, you're actually throttling the number of downloads by a factor between 1 in 20 and 1 in 50. What I mean by that is I got 50,000 downloads of my ebook with no registration whatsoever. Had I put an email requirement on, I would have gotten somewhere between about 2,500 and 1,000 downloads. So between a factor of 50 and a factor of 20 fewer downloads. Because people simply, and I've gotten that through testing, and having other people send me their data from testing, because people simply don't like to register for things. But they'll happily download something. The other thing that happens, and I've tested this too, the other thing that happens is people are very reluctant to blog about or write about on Facebook or tweet about something that has a download requirement. They're very unwilling
right.
to do so.
Yes.
So you're doing two things that are negatives. Number one, you're actively putting up a barrier to people reading your ideas. And number two, you're actively putting up a barrier from people spreading your ideas. And to me, those far outweigh collecting a few email addresses.
That's very interesting. So this is your absolute bestseller. So I want to ask you the Elizabeth Gilbert,
yeah.
you know, eat, love, pray question. So this was just obvious. This must have taken you a little bit by surprise, but, you know, huge.
Yeah, some data, 300,000 copies in English, and it's in 26 other languages.
26. All right, well, I got
yeah.
that on your website's out of date already. So now you've since written, is it 4 books? I can't remember exactly what, or real-time marketing.
I've got 8 altogether. So The New Rules of Marketing and PR was my third. So I've got 8 altogether. So I've done 4 since then.
Four since then. So
or 5.
Real-time marketing
even,
PR. So we've been spending a lot of time figuring out what the idea is for the book idea for the mm-hmm. authors who are doing the program, because this is
right.
so key. And in fact, your title, The New Rules of Marketing and PR, it's in the title. So it sets up the promise that you're going to give us The New Rules of Marketing and PR.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
The book is very all-encompassing. So one of the questions I've had for you is, how did you come up with your ideas for your subsequent books, which in a sense are kind of like subsets of your first book? And how was that hard, and how did that work?
Yeah, I mean, they're not really, because I wrote Marketing Lessons from the Grateful Dead, which is completely different.
I forgot that one, yeah.
Newsjacking is pretty different. A few things. The first thing is you have an interesting observation. Because I'm best known for a book called The New Rules of Marketing and PR, I've got to market my business the same way that I suggest other people market their business, which is, this is a personal reason why I don't use email addresses. But getting back to the question you asked is, I've only written nonfiction since my first book. My first book was a novel. It was a thriller, actually, called Eyeball Wars. Everything since then has been nonfiction. But when I write a nonfiction book, I am constantly thinking about patterns that I see. And when I start to see a pattern, I'll blog about it. And if it's a big pattern, I'll blog about it again in another way, and then again in another way. And I'm not necessarily consciously thinking of it yet. But then if I see that the pattern has coalesced where I'm kind of blogging around the same topic quite a bit, I realize that's actually a book. And so with The New Rules of Marketing and PR, what I what I started to write about was the idea that marketing and public relations on the web isn't in any way like marketing and public relations offline, because essentially what marketing and PR on the web is you have to create content that people want to consume and that they're eager to share. And so that was the pattern I saw. The pattern I saw was that marketing is really about publishing content on the web. And that's what the book, you know, that's 450 pages boiled down to a sentence. With my book called Real-Time Marketing and PR, what I realized is that all of business, but in particular marketing, is now a real-time endeavor. But every marketing department is set up around campaigns, around long-term planning. So I realized that it's more like a trading floor and less like a traditional advertising agency to be successful with what's going on today in terms of marketing on the web. So these are the kind of big picture patterns that my mind sees. And then I know that if I've got a big picture pattern, that I've got something that's worthy of a book. I'm not the kind of writer that tries, you know, that jumps onto a bandwagon or who says, you know, I need to make a how do you become successful book or whatever. Or, you know, I don't think that way. I kind of write for myself in a way. I kind of think, oh my gosh, there's something really cool going on out there. I have to put it down because I feel like I'm the first person to identify this trend.
You know, I think you even use the word cool a lot. The way you write to me always sounds exactly like you, and I get such a kick out of it.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think there's the way that I write is that exactly right. I just the way I talk, and so for me, there's no real such thing as writer's block, which is why I've been able to do 8 books in 10 years, because I can just crank them out.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about your writing process. But recently, I know Seth Godin has said this a couple of times, but he says there's no such thing as talker's block.
Yeah, you know, that's right.
What is our problem with writer's block? And that is a very, very interesting observation, because I think for many of us, we shift into this different mode where it has to sound different. The sentences have to come out differently. So tell us a little bit more about your writing process. Are you saying you never suffer from writer's block? You don't procrastinate?
No, it's
no
not
challenges.
That.
Tell us, Bruce.
I do procrastinate. I do have days where I just don't want to write anything. Yeah, absolutely. But the first thing is I use my blog as a really important aspect of my longer form projects, the books, because that's where I test ideas. That's where I look for feedback. That's where I go to see that I've got these patterns forming in my mind where I'm, you know, over the course of 2 months, I wrote the same kind of thing 5 different ways. And sometimes I don't even realize it until I go back and reread old posts. And so the blog is really, really important. And so I might write on the blog for 9 months, and I'm kind of thinking in the back of my mind, gee, it's time to think about a new book. What should I do? I'll go back and look, and then that'll help me to have an idea that'll coalesce. Then if I'm in book mode, and I've got a contract, and I've done most of my all of my books with Wiley since the new rules. So if I have a book idea, I just tell them, and you know they always say yes. So I've gotten to the point where I'm under contract for a book. I'm like, okay, now I need to go from half a dozen blog posts to 75,000 words. And my process there is that I grab those blog posts, copy and paste them, and use them as kind of a starting point for writing chunks. And I don't make an outline. I don't make a table of contents. I just start writing chunks and then kind of, you know, almost like a chessboard, figuring out where they go as I'm writing. And I personally write in the morning. I don't like to write in the afternoon. In the afternoon, I do things like email and like this call, for example. These are the sorts of things I like to do in the afternoon and to use a different part of my brain. And then as I'm writing chunks, I have an editor that I've worked with for a while who I pay. They're not with my publisher. And that editor will look at the chunks and provide feedback. And then I'll start to see a sort of a structure start to form, and then I'll start to see a table of contents start to form. But that's always a work in progress as I'm writing. And then it kind of comes together, and it's done when it's done. You know, as you know, it's like never done, so you have to at some point put a period at the end and say it is done. And then Wiley's editors take over, and we do another round with Wiley's editors. But I'm a big believer in having someone who works for me do the first round of edits.
Well, you know, when that editor, your own editor, is working with you, by the time you send that person something in your Word document, I mean, I'm going to take it that it's fairly coherent.
Yeah,
your blog already is coherent.
It is coherent, but it's just a chunk. It's 1,000 words. It's 800 words. It's 2,500 words. It might be a complete chapter. I've done that before. Or it might just be two stories that are strung together somehow. They're chunks. And that's what that editor typically looks at. He doesn't look at entire book in one go. He doesn't look at, I mean, sometimes but rarely does he look at a chapter in one go.
So what kind of feedback does he give you? Or what kind of feedback are you looking for?
I'm looking for, is this section working as a standalone?
Oh, okay.
He does a white line edit. I mean, I don't obsess over every little period, but, you know, he'll tell me things that are wrong from a grammatical point of view and whatnot. But then he'll say things like, this is unclear, or he'll draw a connection to something else he's read of mine. He'll say, oh, you know, 3 weeks ago you sent me this, and this is kind of similar, and then that might help me to realize that this thing and the thing I sent 3 weeks ago might fit together somehow.
It's interesting. It's a very organic process. Well, I have two questions that are related. One is your audience, your reader, very clear in your mind when you're writing the book? But then you also just said you kind of write for yourself. But what about that question?
That's interesting. I mean, let's just take the new rules of marketing PR for a second. I'm currently, as we speak, and I was doing before I jumped on this call, working on the fourth edition of that book, believe it or not. It's currently in its third edition. I'm working on the fourth edition. And when I first wrote the book in 06, as I was writing, and it came out in 07, but I was writing in 06, I thought that my reader was a marketing person in a company. And in fact, quite a number of marketing people and companies read my book. But as the book came out, and as I started to get feedback, and as I started to read Amazon reviews, and as people started to email me, and as I started to meet people at conferences and whatnot who have read the book, I realized that the bigger audience for this book is actually business owners and entrepreneurs and executives of large companies, less so the people who work in marketing and public relations departments. Although they are a market, they weren't as big a market as I thought comparatively. So now, as I'm writing the fourth edition of this book, I am definitely thinking of the entrepreneur. And as I'm writing, I actually wrote a section this afternoon about Adagio Teas. And it's an entrepreneurial company. It's run by a family. They've got about 20 employees. It's doing really, really well. They do great online marketing. And as I'm writing this little chunk, I'm thinking to myself that the audience that I'm writing to is another entrepreneurial family-owned, not necessarily family-owned, but another entrepreneurial business owner who is perhaps struggling with the idea of how they can reach people online. So, yeah, I am keeping that person in my mind. But interestingly, as I wrote the first edition of that book, I had the wrong person in mind.
What does that say to you? I mean, that's very interesting. What does that say to you that it is the entrepreneur or the business owner or the executive who wants to read this? Doesn't that
to be honest
about marketing and PR?
To be honest with you, I think I was lucky that I wrote my book at the right time. I was at the right time in the right place. If I hadn't written that book, someone else would have written that book. I mean, the entrepreneurs were dying to understand how to reach people on the web. They all knew that there's something going on. I mean, granted, this is 5 years ago, right? So 06. No, more than that, six years ago, almost 7 years ago. As I was writing, it was those entrepreneurs were thinking, there's something going on the web. You know, this is before Twitter, this is before Facebook, so it was fairly early, but they were saying, you know, people are blogging. And, I mean, you remember that. That was right around the time the corporate blogging book came out. People were blogging. There's people are reaching customers through the search engines. You know, email newsletters are important. You know, these things are important, and yet no one had really, truly cracked the code and figured it out. And so those entrepreneurs are the ones who are kind of on the hook to produce the business. And the marketers were kind of, I mean, they still are sort of set in their ways, and it's hard to get a marketer to move. You know, they're happily doing their TV commercials or whatever they're doing. I'm being a little bit cynical, but it's the entrepreneurs that have their, you know, their livelihood on the line, their life savings on the line in some cases, who are the ones who are really were really eager to figure that out. And I think that in a way I was lucky that they were looking at that time, because then that they found my book, and then that, you know, started the whole, I almost call it a franchise now because I'm on the fourth edition of it.
I love that. Well, I'm going to ask you about your blog in just a sec, but first, talk, David, a little bit about all the speaking you do that is based on your books. One of my questions is, do you think about the presentations you're going to give? Are you kind of baking those into the book, you know, while you're doing the writing? Or is it you just figure that out later? Because that is also your livelihood, as I understand it.
Yeah, I get most of I generate most of my revenue from the speaking engagements. I have three main sources of revenue: the speaking engagements, have the books. And by the way, when you sell several hundred thousand copies of a book, you actually do make money in a book. I mean, everyone says you don't make money on books, and that's generally true, but if you start to sell multiple numbers, then there is a pretty decent revenue stream. But yeah, most of my revenue comes from speaking business. The third form of revenue is that I'm an advisor to a number of companies. And by the way, I don't take any cash; I take all stock. And one of the companies that I was in, and I'm an advisor of, they went public this year, and they just got acquired by Oracle. So that'll be a nice payday. The lottery ticket idea of taking stock rather than cash has paid off in this case. Gosh, what did you ask me? I forgot.
Well, it was about the speaking, and the reason is because.
Yeah. So when I write all of the books I've written, all the nonfiction books I've written have been story dominated. I tell stories of success. I don't preach and say, here's how you do this. I say, look at this awesome example of how somebody achieved success. Here's why they were successful. And so in a typical book, I might have 30 or 40 or 50 small examples of success, and I interview the people and find out directly from them how they were able to achieve that success. Then when I'm crafting a speech, I go back and look at those examples that I put into the books, and then those serve as the basis for the presentations, because the presentations are the same thing. My presentations are story-driven. They're me telling stories about people's success with, you know, with social media, with real-time marketing, with the new rules of marketing and PR, and how they have been able to reach their buyers by implementing some aspect. You know, they started a blog, or they or they're active on Twitter, whatever it might be, and I use the example of telling the story of how they became successful. And in the speeches and in the books, people react to stories. You know, they absolutely react to stories. They love stories. You know, I mean, we humans, it was the first form of communications. We told stories. It's still the form of communications that people love. You know, if you go to a bar and say, I want to tell you a story, people listen. If you go to a bar and say, let me tell you about your product, they don't.
How do you actually get all these examples? Obviously, your blog is key, but do you also put out?
Well, I mean,
or people,
no. Very rarely do I put out a request. I actually put out one a couple days ago where I asked if anybody has a success with Pinterest that they can share, but that's extremely rare. I don't think I've done that in the last 2 years. No, they mostly come my way somehow. I'll find something in my travels. This Adagio tea example I told you about that I wrote about, I was writing about today, my daughter told me about it. She's 19. She's a college student. She loves this kind of tea, and she's telling me all about how they do their marketing and whatnot, just because she loved it, not because she was expecting for me to write about it. I thought, wow, this is a perfect example of something that can go into my blog and then into a book. Basically, the short answer is I open my mind to serendipity. I open my mind to an example that's surprising, and as soon as other people are talking about it, I'm not interested. You know, I have, except once when I bash them, I don't write about Zappos. Everybody writes about Zappos. I could care less about Zappos. I want to find the Adagio teas of the world that nobody's written about before.
Do you get you must get emails, because now people know you put stories in your book.
I get a lot. Yeah, I get a lot. I get a lot of emails. I get a lot of tweets. Most of them are not appropriate, but everyone's
talking. Okay, they're not interesting. Okay.
Well, a lot of them are like PR people who, you know, they don't understand exactly what I'm looking for, and it's just not appropriate. But yeah, I do have people who will sometimes tell me about something, and it's ideal. It's fantastic. I'll get a lot of people who have read the books. You know, they'll read one of the books, and they'll say, wow, you know, I just ran across this. It sounds just like the sort of thing you'd be interested in. You know, they'll send me a video or something on YouTube, and it's like, yeah, that's cool, and I write about it.
So your blog, and I think this is important for, you know, for the up-and-coming authors listening, is absolutely key.
Yeah, it's critical.
The writing on your blog,
most important
on your
thing.
Blog, and you know, here's an obvious question: if an expert wants to write a short book but they don't have a blog, are they doomed? Do you just absolutely have to have a blog?
I don't think that you absolutely have to have anything, but I think that having a blog, at least for me, has been the most important thing that I did, by far. And I just don't think there's any way that I could be doing what I'm doing now if I didn't have it. So for me, it's absolutely critical. There's always examples of people who have become a success without a blog, but I think that you're putting yourself at a disadvantage if you're not actively putting your ideas out there in a way that people can find them on search engines who have never heard of you, in a way that people can share through social networks like Facebook and Twitter. I mean, I think you're really putting yourself at a disadvantage if you're not putting yourself out there in a way that people can find out what you're up to and kind of get a taste of your thought process before they buy it, actually, you know, reach in their pockets and pay 10 or 15 bucks for a book.
Well, I would tend to agree with you, but then it's just sort of the matter of practicality. I mean, I think, as I understand it, Guy Kawasaki has pretty much stopped blogging regularly, but he's adopted Google Plus as his new
yeah.
of choice, and he's on there all the time.
Yeah, well, that's blogging. I mean, it's just semantics. Yeah. It's still blogging. He's still writing something that people can access.
Yeah. Now, your latest series is you've been writing a preface to a series of books on marketing for Wiley. Now, one of my questions is this to give you a break from writing?
No, not at all. It's supplemental. Basically, when the new rules came out, a lot of people would reach out to me and goes, wow, can you write a whole book on, say, social media metrics, or can you write a whole book on search engine optimization, or can you write a whole book on video? And I couldn't. I don't have time, and I wasn't the expert. So the idea is that I find an expert for different topics. Wiley also helps to find those people. We sign them to the series if they're appropriate, if the right kind of author. Then I coach them through the writing process, and then I do the forward to the book. And then I help them with their marketing and promotion and whatnot. And there's 6 books in the series right now. It's worked out really well. But it's in no way a substitute in any way to my own work. It's supplemental to my own work.
How do you coach them through the writing process?
Well, I have a couple of conference calls here and there, but it's not a whole lot. But you know, as much as they need, I will try to help. So it's calls like that we're having right now. It's pointing them to some of the blog posts I've written and others have written, things like that.
It's kind of acting like a consulting editor.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to look at it. I mean, I don't get into heavily editing their work. I mean, I'll read it and I'll provide a bit of advice and I'll read it so that I can write an intelligent forward. But I'm not in there, you know, manipulating paragraphs with them.
What are your thoughts on self-publishing, which is now, I think 2013 is the year of self-publishing, totally legitimized, but, you know, as an option for lesser-known or first-time authors, because obviously you have tremendous leverage with Wiley, but most, you know, unknown or lesser-known authors don't, and they're not going to get a contract. So what are your thoughts on this whole new movement?
It's not a new movement. My first book, which came out in 2001, was self-published. It's a novel called Eyeball Wars.
I was going to mention that. By the way, I've read that book. I absolutely loved it.
Thank you. Yeah.
But don't let me finish without asking if you think
it's
a novel.
It's a thriller. Yeah. So, I mean, if I hadn't had and self-publishing was a really freaking hardback then, much harder than it is right now. It was critically important for me. Got my first book out. My second book was with a small publisher. I got a tiny advance, and that was also great. My third book was with Wiley, a major publisher, and all the bells and whistles. Self-publishing is fantastic, and I would certainly do it again with the right book. If you count the free e-books that I did, I've self-published, I don't know how many there are now, probably half a dozen books. I mean, they're short, 5,000 to 10,000 words, but I've done a bunch of books myself, although not with ISBN numbers and all that other stuff. I only did that with the one book, Eyeball Wars. Absolutely. There's no question that is definitely a route to go. There's the self-published route, there's the small publisher route, and there's the big publisher route. And I don't think any one is better than any other. I think they're different options to get your work out there.
So what's next? Are you working on another book? If it's on your site, I might have missed it.
I am, as I said earlier, I'm working on the 4th edition of the New Rules of Marketing PR.
Okay.
And I'm also working on another book, which will come out in January of 2014. And this is interesting, Debbie. I when I was writing New Rules Marketing PR and some of the books that came just after that, I blogged about it as I was writing. I kept my readers informed of my project. I talked about the new book as I was writing it. And I think, I haven't researched this, but just anecdotally, I think people are sick of that. I mean, I think when I did it, it was good. And way back in 2006, the idea of blogging sections of a book was pretty new. The idea of keeping your readers informed as you're going through the writing process is pretty new. But I think so many authors have done that right now, and I think a lot of people get to the point where they feel like they know the book so well that they don't need to buy it.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
And the last two books I've written, actually they're not the last two, but actually certainly with Marketing Lessons from the Grateful Dead, which I wrote with Brian Halligan, he's the CEO of HubSpot, and Bill Walton wrote the foreword to that book. We announced it the day it came out, and we kept it quiet till the day it launched on Amazon. That was hard, actually, because there were a lot of signs that we were doing this, and a few people could have spilled the beans who learned about it, but it didn't leak. And it was great because we made a big freaking splash and people paid attention and they bought the book and the media cared about it and MSNBC interviewed us and we were in the London Times and it was just great because it was just a big splash. I did the same thing with Newsjacking, the most recent book, which came out about a year ago. And that book, I didn't talk about it till it came out, and then it came out, and bang, it was huge. And I think that's the way I'm going to continue to do it. I think that, you know, I don't think people care enough about what I'm doing to eagerly await my missives on my latest writing project. I'd rather have them buy the book that's out than wait for the book that's not out. So, for that reason, I've got a book coming out January 2014, but I'm not talking about it yet.
Okay. David, can we take a couple questions? I've unmuted everyone.
Yeah, sure.
Anyone there want to ask David a question? And everyone is unmuted, so jump in there. You've got a question.
Hey, this is Paul. I got a question.
Hey, Paul.
Do you write with dragon speak, talking and recording, or do you write by typing?
I type. I definitely type. However, as I mentioned before, with my nonfiction books, I do a lot of case story, storytelling, and I do a lot of putting into the words of the people who have been successful using the ideas I talk about. So what I do is I record my interviews on the phone with my recording device, and then I send that recording out to be transcribed. So I'm making sure that the quotes are accurate of the people that I'm interviewing. But I don't do that for my own words. I don't use any technology at all. I just type.
Okay, good.
Interesting. That's sort of a nice combo.
Yeah. It works for that approach works for me.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
I got another question.
Okay.
Do you tell stories of failures?
I do.
Okay.
I tell stories of failure, but they tend to be my own. Or big company failures that's public. I don't ever embarrass people unless it's already a public embarrassment. What I mean by that is if a company does something silly on Twitter and they did that publicly, I might use that as an example of a failure. I'll definitely talk about my own failures. That I don't have any problem with. But I won't embarrass somebody by saying, look at this terrible website, and let's pick it apart and why it's bad. I would never do anything like that.
Yeah, when I advise small business owners as my day job,
uh-huh.
And I find it's never good to offend anybody's reality. But if you can talk about somebody in the third person and kind of make fun of somebody else that helps somebody kind of self-reflect and see themselves in it? Does
yeah.
that work in the writing stories?
I definitely do that, but in a broad sense. Like, for example, and Debbie knows this, I frequently talk about what I call gobbledygook. That's the cutting-edge, mission-critical, best-of-breed language that people use. And so I talk about that in a way that I'm not singling out anybody as being a poor writer, but I'm saying this is how many people speak. And so that's one way of failure. And definitely almost everyone on the planet who's ever written anything can relate to using words like cutting edge and best of breed, because so many people use that crap. So that's one way I can call it out so that people will recognize themselves in that behavior. But I don't do it by saying, oh, look here what XYZ company did. Unless they're a really, really, really big company and they therefore have a very, very, very thick skin. But I certainly wouldn't do it for a mom and pop kind of company.
Thank you.
Incidentally, on your question of do I use any software, speech recognition software, the one thing I have been doing recently is I've been reading my own audiobooks. The first few books I didn't do that. There was a professional reader who the audiobook company hired, but the last, I think, three books, or maybe two books, I can't remember, two or three books, I've read it myself. And that's been really a really interesting process, going to a studio, have a professional sound engineer read the book, and then, you know, seems like every third sentence I make a mistake, we have to go back and redo it, and then we go back and we have to punch in the mistakes, and I mean, the whole process is probably, I don't know, 5 or 10 times the time it takes to actually read a book is how long it takes to do an audio book. And I found that process to be valuable, and according to people who like audiobooks and listen to my books and the type of books that I write, it's good to have the author do that. So anyone who's in that category of having a book that comes out and thinking about the audio book, if you can all read it yourself, it's something to consider.
That's a neat idea. What do you learn about your books by doing that, by the reading aloud?
I find mistakes and things that I wish I had written in a different way, which is actually kind of interesting because it's a nice technique to actually go in and read your manuscript yourself. Here's another little tip. During the editing process, when you're getting near the final edit, print out your entire manuscript in a completely different font. You know, if you're doing Times New Roman, print it out in Arial Narrow or something. You read your book in a different font, it is a different book. And you see things in it that you never would have seen if it's the same old font you've seen for the last year as you've been writing. The same thing's true of reading the book out loud to yourself. You can learn a lot by reading the entire manuscript aloud. In terms of places you stumble that you might need to rework.
Well, David, thank you for saying that, because I actually mentioned those two very techniques earlier.
Oh, you have. Oh, okay.
Talking about self-editing, because they're, I mean, I suppose they're obvious in a way, but in a way they're not.
They're not. No, they're
and
not. I had to. I don't remember who told me those ideas. I didn't think of them myself, but they absolutely work.
I know who told you. Mark Levy.
Could very well have been.
Accidental genius.
Yeah.
Maybe. Anyway.
Could have been, yeah.
Anyway, so one more question, or?
That's Jeff. I have a question.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey. Interested in the speaking circuit, and how do you get your gigs, and what kind of audience are you looking for?
I speak all over the world. I've spoken in 33 different countries to date. I speak in my next gig in 2 weeks is in Cairo. That will be my 34th country. The majority, probably 75% of my engagements come direct. Potential clients will email me and say, hey, I've got this particular conference. Can you come and speak? The rest of the 25 or 30% come through speakers bureaus. I have about 20 bureaus who represent me. And so each one on average might book me once every other year or so. They don't have a huge number of bookings through the speakers bureaus. Basically, the more books you have and the better the books sell, the more in demand you are as a speaker. And the better speaker you become, the more people who are in the audience will want to hire you to speak at their events. I've been very, very focused on my own speaking development and have worked very, very hard over 25 years to hone my speaking style. I've been working with a speaker coach. Well, actually, when I first started speaking, I did Toastmasters for about 6 years. It's a great program to learn how to speak. Then for the last approximately, I guess it must be 5 or 6 years, I've been using a speaker coach. And, I speak, one of the last gigs I did was 2,500 people. I almost always keynote when I speak. I've spoken in front of a lot of, pretty important, pretty big groups. And I charge between $20,000 and $35,000 for a speech, so I'm fairly high-end when it comes to speakers. But I still use a coach because I think, everybody, no matter who they are, can still improve. And, I always find it interesting that, professional athletes all have coaches, even though they're the best athletes in the world. And so that's why I continue to use a speaker coach. But I think that best-selling books, having a blog that a lot of people read, doing a good job when you're on the speaking circuit, all of these things lead to people who want to book you. The other thing is it's critical to have a great speaker video. I just updated my speaker video, and I'm really happy with it. I released it about 2 weeks ago. I think it's the fourth or fifth one that I've had. This one is by far the best. If you go to my website, davidmearmanscott.com, it'll be on a link that's on the front page there. But it's 8 minutes long, and it's got highlights from some of the speeches I've delivered with some commentary that I do. And that's really, really important for having a potential engagement because the people who hire you want to see you in action, and the only way to see you is through a video.
Well, David, I can say from firsthand experience that I think you're a phenomenal speaker. I've heard you speak a number of times.
Thank you, Debbie.
And it's another medium from the writing in your book, but I've just tremendously enjoyed it.
And I love it. I absolutely love it. I mean, I find it. I'm just so happy to have been able to find a career that I absolutely love to do what I do. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, there's nothing better, is there, than having something that you can earn a living with and a good living with, but that you also love.
Well, I think that's the goal. I think that
yeah.
I think you nailed it. And, David, thank you so very much. That was fantastic.
My pleasure. I hope it's helpful to you.
Definitely, and we all join to say thank you very much, and
sure.
Let's stay in touch.
Okay, thanks, Debbie. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.